It is so great for me to be with you all. It reminds me of my first year of college. Went to the Peanut Valley in eastern New Mexico. Anyone been there? Most of the people you know who have been there got lost there. They've never been seen again. I grew up in Kansas, but this place in eastern New Mexico was flatter than any spot in Kansas I had seen. It was a small town. It was a small university, about 4,000 people. And the only reason I went there is because of a couple of scholarships that I got, and it was a nice opportunity to see the world in the middle of the New Mexico desert. I didn't get a scholarship for being smart. It was a good time, but it was a hard time, and what helped me get through it was the campus ministry I was a part of. There was a professor I had named Ollie. Ollie taught literature. But for whatever reason, Ollie thought that literature should be a religion class. And he wasn't a Christian. He thought it was important to identify the Christians and help them not to be Christians anymore. That was tough. Some of the guys in my co-ed dorm wanted to stay up late at night and talk about all kinds of ideas. They were convinced that there was no rational explanation for Christ. They were convinced that Christianity was just some kind of alien religion and loved to talk about all kinds of far-out ideas. There were a couple of guys who lived down the way. They invited me into the room one time, and boy, it was crazy. I didn't know that wallpaper came in centerfold, but their entire... Do you even know what centerfolds were? That was back before the digital era. We didn't have the internet at that time, and so there were these magazines, and that's where people got their porn. It was a hard life for them. It was really tough. But these kids would rip the stuff out and plaster their walls with it. I walked in, it was like, whoa! You know, I'm just a little Christian boy from Kansas. I'd never seen any of that kind of stuff before. It was crazy. The Ouija board was hanging from the corner of the room in a net, and they wanted to invite me into their satanic lair. And I had no idea what to do with that. This is a Christian campus house that helped me to get a brain, to get a mind for Christ. Simple willpower and simple faith was just not enough in that setting. See, everybody around me, Christian and non-Christian, surprisingly, believed that there were really two stories. There was this higher story where values and faith and religion belonged. And then there was the lower story, the one that actually mattered, the one that dealt with the real world. It was facts. It was scientifically provable. It was your experience. It was undeniable and certain. And religion did not belong there. Reason belonged there. And so they divided religion from reason, faith and values from anything real, and made it impossible to think through. But the campus minister there helped me get a mind for Christ and taught me how to read the Word for myself. And it was powerful. It made all the difference. And I needed the help because when I grew up in high school, I was a misfit. Are there any fellow misfits in the room? Yeah. There are other people pointing to you, even though it's dark in here. I can tell. I was that kid who had really no fashion sense. My hair is naturally curly, and there's just nothing you can do with this stuff, okay, except keep it short. But when I was still experimenting in high school, I thought it would be cool to grow it out. And there was a little bit of a time where I thought if I grew it out long enough, I could kind of do like that cool California like surfer thing, you know? And like, you know, all the girls would be attracted to like my bronze body and like my tough like voice thing. But my hair wouldn't hang down like the beach guys. My hair just kinked up tighter and tighter and tighter. And it was like a Q-tip on the top of my head. It was a literal afro. I just couldn't do anything with it. And all my friends wanted me to keep growing it out when they saw that it could be an afro. They wanted to see how big I could get it, right? Stick one of those little picks in it. This was Kansas. We had to find something to do. I decided I was going to shave the sides of my head. I could give it some shape, right? I wasn't quite a mohawk, and it wasn't a faux hawk. I like to call it a frohawk. just kind of this, yeah, it wasn't good. I wore an earring back when I had my ear pierced. People were just getting their ears pierced, and guys only pierced their left ear, Cody Monkman. I had to do that, man. But guys only pierced their left ear. Now, they would get a diamond stud or some kind of a gold medal stud or something in there, but I didn't want to do that. I thought it'd be cool to get like this big hoop, like a Mr. Clean kind of a thing, and just hang it there, you know, like a pirate kind of a deal. It was, I was a misfit. And I guess that's where my son got it. my son has always struggled to fit in as well. He's 15 now, and he's in counseling, so he's getting help for it. I'm kidding. It's a joke. He's not here. I can say whatever I want. When he was in kindergarten, he went to public school in Dallas, Texas. That's where we lived when he was born, and we lived there 10 years while I was in ministry. And he was at school pointing to something on the paper with his teacher. And his teacher, Mrs. Pfaff, who'd been teaching for like 130 years, she said, "Oh, Ryder, don't point with that finger. That's your dirty finger." He looked down and he said, "Oh, no, that's just a mole." You know, my son had to learn about the dirty finger from his kindergarten teacher. Christians, I think, have a tough time fitting in, but it goes way beyond fashion. It goes way beyond dirty fingers and dirty language. Christians struggle with where they fit into the world. At least that's been my experience. It's not a new problem. Actually, in Jesus' day, the people of God really struggled to figure out how they fit in. Rome was occupying the Holy Land, and prior to that time, for more than 600 years, somebody occupied God's promised land. It was the Assyrians and the Babylonians and the Persians and the Greeks and the Medes, and eventually it was the Romans. These pagan, ungodly governments who worship fertility cults and idols, they occupied and ruled over God's promised land and his chosen people. By the time that Jesus was doing his ministry, God had been silent for 400 years. They hadn't heard from a prophet. They hadn't had one of their own set on the throne. And they were waiting for the Son of Man. They were waiting for the Messiah, for the chosen one who would split apart the sky and come down on his white horse with his legion of armies behind him, the hosts of heaven, and make everything right. But in the meantime, what are you supposed to do if you're one of God's? The Essenes were one of four groups I want to tell you about. Say Essenes. Yes, you're very good. The Essenes were a group of people who thought, we can't have anything to do with Rome or Roman civilization or Roman rules, so they took a hike to the desert and lived in caves. They decided the best way to deal with Rome was not to deal with Rome. There were two other groups that tried to play political power games. There were the Sadducees. Can you say Sadducees? Of course you can. The Sadducees were kind of the political liberals. They were the ones who were the progressives. They thought if we just get along with Rome, we can get what we want out of them. We can get enough power that we can begin to take over. And so they played that side of the political game. But there was another group called the Pharisees. You're probably familiar with them, aren't you? The Pharisees played a different political power game. It was the conservative game. We're going to make a bunch of rules. We're going to be kind of sticks in the mud. We're not going to go along with anything. We're just going to fight, but we're going to fight in a political way. We're going to resist. Both groups wanted power through political means. The fourth group was a group called the Zealots. The Zealots were ready to overthrow. They carried swords and spears in their socks and their waistband and their cloaks, and they were ready to stab anyone and to take over by force. And those were your four options if you were going to be one of God's faithful in a world where you really didn't fit. Do you see the parallels around you? Even on this campus, even in this room, people who are trying to figure out, if I'm going to be faithful, how do I do that? Do I just run to the desert and hide in a cave? Do I play the political game? Or do we just need to overthrow? Paul gives us a great example of another alternative. If you'll turn to Acts chapter 17. Wow, all those pages rustling. It was like a wind across my face. It was exciting. Acts 17. Paul goes to Athens, and he gives us an alternative to those four. Let me just read a big chunk of this, and then we'll go back through and pick some things out. Starting with verse 16. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace, day by day with those who happened to be there. A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to dispute with him. Some of them asked, "What is this babbler trying to say?" Others remarked, "He seems to be advocating foreign gods." They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. Then they took him and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus, where they said to him, "May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? You're bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we want to know what they mean." All the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. Paul then stood up in the Areopagus, and he said, "Men of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' Now, what you worship is something unknown. I am going to proclaim to you." So the scene is Paul in Athens, walking around in all their fancy buildings, seeing idols everywhere. The primary issue Paul was dealing with was idolatry. What are the idols around you? Let's try to imagine what a replay of this would look like in our setting. Think about these idols. There's Gaga, the idol of celebrity. There's Trump, the idol of success or capitalism. There's Seacrest, the idol of worthless TV. There's G.I. Joe, the idol of war. The elephant and the donkey and the teabag, idols of democracy. There's Apple, the idol of technology. There's the Cubs, the idol of losing. I'm sorry. I'm from Texas. I'm a Rangers fan. Paul, as he walked around Athens, saw these pillars everywhere with idols on top of them, stone and wood images of creatures that had to be woken up in the morning. They had to be fed. They had to be bathed and cleaned. And these were gods. These were deities. These things had power over your life, right? And Paul just walks around. He's distressed. He's worked up over it. But he's thinking. He's analyzing. He's trying to figure out what it all means. What's behind it all. Finally, when he speaks up, in the Areopagus, he says, "I see that in every way you are very religious." Another word for this word religion or religious is superstitious. Right? This is rabbit's feet. This is blowing out birthday candles. This is throwing a coin over your shoulder into the water. This is tossing salt over the other shoulder. This is avoiding black cats and ladders and shattered mirrors and umbrellas in the room. This is that Facebook when somebody says, "You got to like pass this status on or you don't care, man." right? Superstitious. Are there any athletes in the room? Like true hardcore jock athletes? I mean, like you, like when you win a game, you've got some kind of superstition. Any crazy superstitions you're willing to shout out? What, did somebody say game bra? Did I hear that? Really, did I hear that? Did you just say that? Okay. I thought maybe sweaty socks or, you know, eating at Jimmy John's or something like that. But any, like, true sport superstitions in the room? You eat at Panera before games. Does it help? Yes, okay. You had to think about it. Any others? Any great sports superstitions? Thank you. That's the one I actually had in my notes. You saw that, didn't you? Lucky socks. Now, how long have you worn these lucky socks? Oh, my gosh. That's amazing. And what kind of shape are they in? Yeah. Do they have holes in them? Okay. That just makes it better, doesn't it? It feels great. So the Athenians were like so hardcore idolaters that they had these pillars everywhere with these stone and wooden images on them and signs just to make sure everything was covered. They even had an altar to an unknown god just to make sure they got it all, right? They didn't want to leave anything out. So they said, just in case, here's the generic one. But it wasn't just specific idols with specific rituals. They were incredibly superstitious about the fates, about the gods and the energies and how they worked in the universe. Paul just walks around and he says, man, you got a lot of superstitious energy here. If I walked in your room, would I be able to tell by looking at the walls what you're superstitious about? What you idolize, what your value system is? Would I be able to tell by looking at the pictures on your phone or your profile pictures on Facebook? Would I be able to tell what your idols are or what you're superstitious about, what you cross your fingers for? Paul was able to do that instantly in Athens. But enough of the sweaty socks, the superstitions. What did he do about it? This is so powerful, and this is the point of Acts 17 that I want you to hear tonight. You don't just have to run to the cave and say, I'm not going to have any part of this. You don't have to get all caught up in the political wrestling match and do the power grab thing. And you don't have to just overthrow. Christians can do a whole lot more than protest, make big signs, shout big slogans, put their bumper stickers on. Christians can actually, believe it or not, think. I know it's shocking, isn't it? They can reason. Look with me here in Acts 17 and see what Paul's response is. He was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols, so he reasoned. He thought. He analyzed. He logicked. He argued. He debated. He conversed. Are you getting it? He thought. It's not a dirty word. Look where he thought. He reasoned in the synagogue. You know what the synagogue was? The synagogue was that teaching house, that little tutoring place that was what the Jews set up when they were exiled from the promised land and they were far away from the temple. The walls had been burned down anyway. They couldn't offer sacrifices anymore. They built these little synagogues, these little teaching houses, just so they could have a place to go and read the scriptures and pray and teach their kids Sunday school. They had little flannel graphs. It was beautiful. And Paul, because of the idolatry around Athens, said, I better go hit that church. I better make sure they're thinking straight. He reasoned in the church. The church always has the problem of absorbing so much of the culture around them that you can't tell the difference. They don't look like Jesus anymore. They look like their neighbors. So Paul knew it was important to get into the church. Second place is he went to the marketplace day by day with those who happened to be there. The marketplace was like the mall. Anybody here go to a mall anymore? No, because it's just a bunch of junior high kids, right? It's a bunch of kids whose parents dropped them off and thought the security guard was a babysitter, right? Malls are no fun anymore. The marketplace in this time was a collection of people who came to sell their stuff. People who had come from fishing or making rugs or clothes or gardening or gathering in their fields. They would bring their stuff to the marketplace to sell to other people. It was like a mall, except without the junior high kids. They were busy out in the fields where they belonged. And while they were there selling their stuff and shopping, they would talk about ideas. While the women are going from booth to booth to booth, the men are all sitting over on the side talking about whatever is current. The marketplace wasn't just a place to sell things. It wasn't just a place to make money. It wasn't just a place to buy new things that you wanted. It was a place to share ideas, to talk about what really mattered in the universe. And when you look at our marketplaces on cable television or on the internet, it's a wasteland of thought. Is there anybody really reasoning in those marketplaces? The word for amusement, when you break it down, to muse is to think. What does it mean to amuse? You negate the thinking. You turn it off. In fact, that's how we talk when we sit down in front of a movie or when we want to watch a bunch of videos. We're wanting to shift it into neutral, to shut down, just to chill, right? Where does the thinking happen? Where does the reasoning happen? That's what the marketplace was for in their time. But there's a third place that Paul went, and this is the one that you need to hear. The Areopagus, it's a big fancy name for the academy. The school, the university. Listen to this. It sounds just like here every day, doesn't it? All the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. It was a lecture hall, right? Come in, sit down in your seat and listen and take notes. Four-syllable words. They were super impressed by the hugity of their smartitude, right? They're impressing each other by how big their brains are. Heads are all hanging over to the side. The academy was the place where people thought about things that mattered. They asked big questions. Who are we? Where are we? What's wrong? What's the solution? They thought about the big questions of life. And Paul was not afraid to go there. And he didn't go there with a guitar and a David Crowder CD. He didn't just go there to say, you need to pray and sing about how much you love Jesus. That's important. But when he went to the academy, he said, I can think with you. And he reasoned with them. I wonder if you could do that here, now, with your Professor Ollie's and your Dan's that I had to deal with my first year in New Mexico. Are you willing to think? Christian Smith wrote a book 7 years ago, published a book called Soul Searching, which was the result of the largest survey done in history of American teenagers and their spirituality. In 2005, he published the book Soul Searching. 5 years later, in 2010, he published the book Souls in Transition, which was the same kids 5 years later. Here's what he found out. Are you ready for the good news? You want the good news? This is about you. Where were you in 2005? In the mall, right? Cody, you laughed too hard. You were there, weren't you? Okay. We go a long way back. I have permission, don't I? It's love, right, Cody? Yeah, yeah. Here's what he said. The good news is this. Americans are passing on their faith successfully. Catholic parents have Catholic kids. Buddhist parents, Buddhist kids. Atheist parents, atheist kids. Baptist parents have Baptist kids. Who knew that would happen, right? But here's the bad news. They're only accepting the label. Christian Smith said, these kids are not actually thinking about the important issues that make up that faith. They're not owning the faith. They're just slapping the label on and wearing it. They've backgrounded, that's his word, they background the big questions of life. He's talking about you. In 2005, when he says that, he says, you've actually invented a new religion. He calls it moralistic therapeutic deism. Moralistic means be good, therapeutic means feel good. Deism is don't worry about God, he's close enough to help, but not so close that he's going to interfere. He says, that's the religion of all American teenagers, no matter what label they wear. Remember the two layers I described, the values and faith and religion versus reason and facts in real world. Where does moralistic therapeutic deism fit? Up here. It's not something we want to think about. If that's your brand of Christianity, I just need you to know tonight that's different than Paul's. Paul thought there was enough philosophical power in the meaning of Christ who provides meaning to history and life. There was enough philosophical power in Christ that he could go to the church, to the mall, and to the academy. And here's the response of the people. When they heard about the resurrection of the dead, this is the fancy philosophers, the doctors so-and-so, some of them sneered, of course, but others said, we want to hear you again on this subject. At that, Paul left the council. A few men became followers. Some, others, and a few. Some sneered. You're going to have that. If you dare to reason with people who don't know Christ in the academy, some will sneer. Deal with it. Others will want to talk more. Let us hear you again on this subject. They'll invite you back for more. A few will become followers. Is it worth it? My wife and I are in an awesome time right now in our family. We're loving this phase. My daughter decided she was an athlete. She did not get those genes from me. I have no athletic skills at all. I played the tuba, okay? Another reason why I was a bit of a misfit. But my daughter, a couple of years ago, decided she wanted to play volleyball and basketball. She's a seventh grader now. She'll be eighth grader next year. And she's really coming into her own on the court. In my first year going to all her games, I had such a bad attitude. The bleachers hurt my butt. My back was all sore. It was boring because it was girls' sports. That was just a joke. It was a joke. But I'll tell you what happened this last year. It got fun. It got fun because I watched my daughter come into her own. She wears the number 25, and in the stand, she always hears me go, come on, 25. And I got the whole crowd doing it now. It's awesome, right? They all go, toot, boy, when she comes out. It's great. But here's what makes me even more excited than watching my daughter. She's not actually a star athlete. She's never going to get a scholarship to college off of this. She's going to have fun and work hard, and it's going to be great. But you know what my wife and I are enjoying? We're sitting in the stands with these other parents who don't know Jesus at all. And their opinion of Christian folk is that they're hypocrites, they're stuck up, they don't really care about the world. That's their opinion of Christian people. So when we're sitting in the stands and we're doing this together and we're talking in between games and we're dealing with real life stuff, they're actually getting to know Jesus in a way that they didn't know before. Just in the last 3 weeks, we started to see some major fruit from this. There's a couple in the community that are very well known. Their marriage has just been shattered because he was stupid too many times, too many places. And it's broken a lot of people. And for whatever reason, they reached out to my wife and I for some stability, for some understanding. They've been in church 3 weeks. We've had multiple Bible studies with them at their request. They're changing basic habits and patterns in their life. What they're doing is they're knocking over the idols, because in a time of crisis, their superstitions, their rabbit's feet and birthday candles and crossed fingers and sweaty socks couldn't help. But because we reasoned with them about Christ, they're finding answers that make a difference. You don't have to be flashy. You don't have to use six-syllable words. You just have to be faithful. And you have to be willing to have a conversation. Some, others, and a few. Will you just talk to them? Let me pray for you. Jesus, we feel like the distance between us and unbelievers is so far apart. It's hard for us to know how to talk to them about everyday things or about you. Lord, teach us to trust you to provide those opportunities. Teach us to trust you to bring it up. Help us to have the courage to speak up. Not like we know it all, but like we're seeking for truth. And we believe that Jesus has it. Together, tonight, Jesus, that's why we're here. We believe you make life meaningful. So it's in your name that we've come together. It's in your name we pray. And it's in your name we're going to leave. Amen.